The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on July 17, 2005. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. An interesting anecdote involving Bertrand Russell crossed my path this week, and thought it was quite interesting. So I just wanted to share that with you today, maybe say a few words about what's going on in this little story. But Bertrand Russell, you know Bertrand Russell, the British philosopher, 20th century, and one of my favorite philosophers, really. He's a pretty good guy. And I always liked him. For one thing, he was always very clear, which helped a lot. A lot of times I think philosophers get bogged down in a lot of language, convoluted language, so we don't know really what they're talking about. With Russell, you always knew. So he was always open to attack, and he was attacked a lot. Rightly so, perhaps, in some cases. But anyway, this is a little story. One day, someone approached Bertrand Russell and asked him if he would be prepared to die for his beliefs. And Russell said, of course not. I may be wrong. Yeah, you think, well, this is the great philosopher, Bertrand Russell. This is your philosophy, I may be wrong. Somehow it seems kind of weak. Yeah? We admire people with strong beliefs. You know, we want to have strong beliefs, perhaps. This is something to be admired. I believe there's a program, I haven't heard it, I don't know if it's on or if it's proposed to come on or what, on NPR, National Public Radio. Something to do with This I Believe, I think might be the title of it, or something like that, where I think they've invited people, or they are inviting people now, like through the web or whatever, to submit some little story, what you believe. We're really interested in that. And as I said, we admire those who seem to have strong beliefs, that they know what they believe, they know what they think, they know where they've got their feet planted. And it seems rather admirable, especially in this world, this topsy-turvy world, where so many things are continuously being uprooted and turned around, and it's very unpredictable, particularly in the human world. What's going on? And what all this stuff with terrorism and all the turbulence and disturbance in the human world? But do you have somebody who can just stand firm through all of this? It would seem, that would be, you know where you are with this, and then you just stand firm. And it seems admirable. Also, there's another program on NPR, which I don't know if I've actually listened to an entire episode of it, but speaking of faith, another word where we confuse that with belief. Faith is a pretty good word. There's a place for that. But and when we so often confuse it with what we think, with what we believe, we don't realize that even though it seems kind of, this is strong, firm, I can plant my feet on this, we don't realize how unstable that is, how topsy-turvy that is, how out of sync with reality that is, and certainly how out of sync it is with what other people think. If they hold devout ideas and opinions and beliefs about something else or something that contradicts what you're thinking, it sets the ground for a lot of a human struggle and difficulty. And yet, you know, we just feel this, we even have these songs like, what is it, I believe for every, I'm not going to sing it, but I believe for every drop of rain that falls, a flower grows, If we ever just examine our beliefs, you realize how ridiculous that one is. You can have a lot of thirsty flowers there. I mean, if every flower only gets a drop of rain. But it sounds inspiring, until we look at it. And we realize, wait a minute. Every one of our beliefs would be like that if we looked at them, if we knew how to look at them, if we could detach our emotional link, our concern for self, our own safety, our protection, our pleasure, that sort of thing. If we could detach that from this and just look at it, we would start to realize that whatever we're hanging to there, far from being something secure and planted and sturdy, it is something very questionable and shaky. Drives us into lifestyles or whatever, into institutions or into just group thinking, where we put the blinders on. We have our agenda, we have our knowledge of right and wrong, and we're going to stand firm here. We have principles and we're going to hold to this. Unfortunately, we don't all agree on what these things are. And then we fight. And this is the human world. So this very thing that we unquestionably take to be something very grounded and solid and good and right and desirable, that we would have firm convictions and beliefs about one thing or another, we don't realize how that links us not only right up front to a lot of pain, suffering, and confusion, but on close examination we would realize that it never connects us to reality at all, ever. Nagarjuna, for those of you who have taken the Nagarjuna classes, shows us this in no uncertain terms. And we're just caught up in our thinking, and most of this thinking has been shaped and formed by our own egoistic desires to please and protect the self, another item that we believe perhaps might be there, but we've never really examined and looked. What are we even talking about there? And we don't know, of course, but we think we do. Well, actually, we don't even really think we do. We don't really think here. We think out there. We think about what we can grasp and take hold of, what I need here to protect this thing here that I've never really examined, but I'm totally preoccupied with. So this is a human confusion, human delusion. It is not enlightenment. Enlightenment, or the awakening of the Buddhas, of those who are awake, what it is that they are clear on is this delusion, is this confusion. We might think that, oh, they have the right idea, they've got the right vision here, they have the right thing there, and if I could just believe in that, whatever it is that they have, if I could just find out what it is that the Buddhas, that the awakened see, then I would trust that, I would believe that. We don't understand that they're not holding to a belief. They're not holding to an idea. They just simply see, and what do they see? They see human confusion and delusion right here in the midst of all the stuff that we're talking about. How it is that we just seem to have this all backwards. Bertrand Russell actually, as weak as it might sound at first glance, well, what a limpy little philosophy that is actually quite profound. I might be wrong. Nagarjuna will help you to see that you are wrong. If you hold to one thing or another, you're wrong. Whatever you're holding to does not match reality, does not match actual experience. And yet, if we don't see that, we go right ahead and we'll reach for something. Another way, too, of looking at this grasping that we do, reaching for something to believe in, seems so admirable, and yet we start to look at what we do when we hold tightly to something. How about someone who they just know they're right and they make their decisions and they go ahead and now they don't look. I've made this decision, I'm just going to go right ahead. This is what I don't complicate the matter with new facts or whatever coming in. This is what we're going to drive through. Well, that's someone who's holding firm to their beliefs, to their convictions, but they're completely out of step with reality, and to the extent that they won't give or budge from that, they are in continuous conflict with reality, with what is going on. We see this kind of thinking certainly in religions. We see this kind of thinking among our political leaders. We see it in business. We see it in all different aspects. We see it in our own personal lives. But what we don't see is the connection between that and our suffering and our confusion and the perpetuation of all this difficulty. And we also don't see that no matter what you are holding to, it never adds up. Never makes sense in the end. Only in some limited way. And that's where it's actually good. It might be functional, useful, helpful. But we confuse what we think for reality, for how it is, and we press that through. This is an enormous problem for human beings. So in Buddhism, as I've said many times, that, you know, Buddhism is not a belief system. And people get kind of confused by that. What do you mean it's not a belief system? Well, don't you believe in the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path? Well, I don't know. Do I believe in that? What does that mean? I believe in the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths are just a way to get us to start to notice our experience. And there's confusion and suffering in our experience. How does this occur? The Four Noble Truths will help us to kind of look at that a little bit. But in the end, is it something we should cling to, hold to, hang on to? Well, the Buddha said that his teachings are like a raft. He sets them aside. He doesn't even hang on to them. Oh, like Bertrand Russell. Well, what kind of philosophy is that? Well, how weak and stupid is that? I want something firm under my feet. But there isn't anything firm. Ever. If we draw our attention back to reality, we realize the thoroughgoing nature of this impermanence that we talk about from time to time. That sometimes can seem kind of scary to us, that there's just this impermanence. Nothing's holding firm, nothing lasts. There isn't any solid ground, solid pillars that you can rest your life upon, etc. That can sound scary, but it's only scary when we think that we ourselves are something solid and substantial, and it needs to rest on something firm. If we really understood the thoroughgoing nature of this impermanence, we would realize that we're not in need of something solid. Just maybe provisionally, from time to time, moment to moment. Jay often makes the statement that there are no true models, accurate models, you know, but some are useful. There's no true rule that we can apply universally. But some of these things are useful, handy. In Buddhism, we speak of that as just kind of a provisional situation. Circumstances evolve in a particular way, and now within a given circumstance, in a limited way, certain rules, ideas are useful, helpful. Are they ultimately real? No, never. And that's where we go wrong, where we start to think that, oh, the truth that we've nailed down here is universal. But what is universal isn't something you can nail down. We should just simply understand that. We should also understand that this nailing down that we think we need to support us and to hold us, to make us feel comfortable, is actually kind of a prison. Nagarjuna describes it as deception. We're being deceived. Painfully deceived horrifyingly. The terror, the horror, the fear. We do this to ourselves by wanting to hold firm to something in a universe, in a reality, in a world where nothing is firm. The firmness and the stability that we find in the universe is not through grasping any one thing. Holding them and say, this is what I believe, this is what I think, this is, because it is not firm. What is firm and doesn't give way is reality itself that has sustained you all along and will continue to do so in spite of everything. This isn't a matter of believing in something because you can't get your mind onto that. You can't form an idea out of this. Well, I sort of did there. But it is a matter of realizing that reality as a whole sustains you and holds you, well, you and everything else. It doesn't hold you separate and apart from anything. But this is in Buddhism where we can place our trust. This is where we place our faith. But it is not in thinking. It is not in believing. It is not holding to some idea here. It is just simply a matter of realizing that, the other way of putting it is just simply that you're having a real, true, genuine experience of reality right now. And nothing to say about that. Anything you hold up about it, even what I just said actually, is excessive and too much. So we get rid of that. We'll get rid of everything. And yet reality is right here. Nothing has changed. It's not just Buddhists, you know, that have thought this way. Sextus Empiricus, one of the ancient Greek skeptics, he said, it is sufficient to live by experience without subscribing to beliefs. He recognized that it is sufficient, far from what we might believe, that we have to have something there to hold to. He recognized that we can live directly by experience without holding to these frozen views that do not match reality. These frozen views that capture us, that bind us, that throw us into opposition with everything and everyone around us. And there's real freedom in that. This is also, I think, what Suzuki Roshi was referring to in this incredible little book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. He has that chapter there, Believing in Nothing. It sounds kind of negative, maybe. Believing in nothing, but he says, I have learned. He's learned. He's an older man now, a man who's practiced many years, who has a very mature practice. This was a pretty solid guy, not in the sense that because he's got his feet firmly planted on something solid, but he's right here in the totality of reality itself. And having immersed himself in that and been watchful of that and looking for that and practicing in this way for many years, he arrives at this point where he says, I have come to realize the necessity of believing in nothing. And then he says, that is to believe in something that is there before all forms and colors appear. So we don't put our belief in something formed, in something particular, an idea, a thing, a person, an institution. Provisionally, we might have to work with these different things, and we can. But ultimately, we should realize that these things do not give us the kind of firm support that we're looking for, all the while ignoring the fact that that support as such, no support's really needed, but that we are already being sustained right from the very start. This is what Suzuki Roshi, I think, was referring to when he said, we trust that which is there before all form and color appear. He said belief, I guess, but perhaps belief wouldn't be the right word at that point. Because when we believe something, we're forming an idea, something graspable. But like I say, we in our culture especially, we keep confusing what we think with reality. And so we think that we can put our trust, our faith in that. Suzuki Roshi, I think, was going directly to that. And he says, that we can believe that which is there before all form and color appear. Are you following that then? So it's just a matter of that we learn to trust what is there. You can't get your hands on it. If you can get your hands on it, if it's an idea, a thought, a belief, a person, an institution, a place, realize that this cannot give you the kind of support that your heart longs for. You can also realize that what your heart most longs for is already here, were we to just finally notice at long last the actual reality that we live out from moment to moment. So we don't need to rely on what we think and what we believe. Like Bertrand Russell, who does a lot of thinking, he probably had a lot of beliefs, ideas, opinions. Would he fight for the death for them? No, I might be wrong. Because whatever we will hold to, you should realize, ultimately, it is wrong. So this is a very important matter, I think. And I think we're kind of slipping into a period in history here, seems to me, kind of with the advent, not the advent, but the rise of fundamentalism and kind of narrowness of thought and political thinking, and where we're becoming more divided and broken off, and we harden our walls, against each other and that sort of thing. I think we tend to do this. Now, here's my speculation, though, my belief. But I think we probably do this because out of fear. Because I think we can all sense the instability in our world today, and it's kind of scary. And out of that fear, that'll make us reach for something, once again, something that seems solid. You can find brothers and sisters, you can gather around you to think the same way, and we just put our blinders on, we wall ourselves in, and now we're just going to forge our way through. We don't realize that we are exacerbating the very problem that we are trying to resolve. We're creating it. We're making it. We're building it. And whether we do it in our own personal lives or collectively in various groups, that's the mechanism. It works in that way. None of us is in control of the whole or of other groups or other people, but certainly we can look at ourselves. And this is our responsibility. And maybe in that way we can learn to move through the world in a way that might help us turn from this this way of fear, this narrowness of thought and brittleness of mind that we easily slip into when we grasp hold of one thought, belief, idea, or another. Particularly when we will do that to use against or defend ourselves against that other over there. That is what we suffer from. That is what is threatening us. That is what is harmful. And the very means that we use to protect ourselves from that drives us into it even deeper. We need to see this. We need to see it in our own life and to see it in our society. And only, I think, in that way. I won't fight for this belief, but I think only in this way will we be able to free ourselves from the kind of peril that we seem headlong to put ourselves in. So a critical issue today, I think. One more thing, too. I was raised in a fundamentalist church, and I don't mean to be critical of any particular church or religion, because that really serves no purpose, but just to point out how a certain kind of thinking actually leads us into this kind of brittleness of mind. Instead of cultivating a mind that is supple and open and magnanimous, tolerant, flexible, willing to, and not arrogant. That's another thing too. We get into this brittle state of mind, we become rather arrogant. Of course, that's out of a fear, once again, to insist that we have it right and to carry on as if you do. But what I have noticed, because I've had a lot of familiarity with it, when we narrow our scope, we narrow our view, we focus in on a certain set of ideas, beliefs, opinions, and we start to hold to that, we actually cross over a sort of a threshold where we'll just tighten that down even more. And where we start to think it's a virtue to be narrow, to be brittle in your mind. No fundamentalists certainly would think that they have a brittle mind. But I have said that they have described themselves, I've heard on many occasions, that they want to be narrow. Richard Dawkins, an evolutionary biologist, one time I heard him debate a group of fundamentalists, he and some other, about evolution. And one of the fundamentalists I got up there, the creationist, but he, at one point he said, but I want to be narrow. For me, it seemed like an odd thing to say publicly in a forum with many people. But I appreciated his honesty. But I realized later that for him that was a virtue. To be narrow, to be rigid in your thinking, to be intolerant. I've heard this spoken at times by people. So these very things, you know, that we can get driven down so deeply, and the fear is so great there, that the intolerance of anything different that might upset what I'm holding to now, that we actually start making virtues out of these very unwholesome and unhealthy states of mind. I think the only way out of this is to realize this mechanism and how easily we can get caught in it ourselves. I'm going to say in our personal lives and in our societies. And I think this is what Suzuki, you know, Roshi said, you know, when he said he has come to realize it is absolutely necessary. That's how he put it, yeah. Absolutely necessary. And I'll just paraphrase him. That we don't hold to anything in particular. That we can just hold to things provisionally, temporarily. While they might be helpful in this moment. But be prepared to discard them in the end. As the Buddha discarded his own teaching in the end. In the sense of not deceiving people into thinking that somehow this is some holy truth we had to hold on to. We let it go. And thereby, the teaching just simply points to the reality that we need to awaken to. I think this is the only way for us to save ourselves. But I won't fight to the death over that. But do you have any questions or arguments about anything I said here today? Yes?
Isn't the trust or belief in ultimate reality, isn't that just another kind of belief?
Belief would be, yes. You said trust or belief in ultimate reality. I don't know what a belief in ultimate reality would be. But trust, if you look at it, we have no choice, really, but to trust that there's no barrier between ourselves and reality itself. If there were, well then, the game's up, it's over. I mean, what difference does it make at this point? We're not veiled from the truth, or the truth is not veiled from us. All of us, we see, hear, experience, our perceptual experience is identical to that of an awakened person. And we have the power within ourselves to awaken. It's simply a matter of trusting that. But it's actually, you know, whatever I say, of course, is an idea formed, and then we could believe that. But I don't want you to believe anything I'm saying here. But if you notice your experience, you will realize that this is what is direct. This is what you have. This is what we know. And if we don't say anything about it, if we don't try to encapsulate it in a thought or idea, formulate it in some way, none of this is necessary. We don't need to do this. And if we don't do that, we will be, and this is what Suzuki Roshi, I think, was saying, it's important that we believe in nothing. We don't start forming something here. He calls it nothing. I wouldn't say it's nothing, but that we just don't make something of it. Nothing particular, I would say. And we don't need to do that, contrary to what we might think. Then we are, or at least we keep the veils between us and ultimate reality quite thin. and they're constantly just being exchanged and changed from time to time. In other words, we will have ideas, we will have thoughts, but we don't hold to them. We don't turn them into veils of concrete and steel and things like that, where we truly blind ourselves to what is going on. So in the end, it leaves us with really nothing to say. Because you say, well, what is it that you think? Well, actually, nothing in particular. Give me something and I might have a few thoughts regarding this or that. But I won't hold any of them so tightly as to go to war over it. I know that it is all provisional, temporary, soon to be, all of this will soon be forgotten. Look at all the wars and things that we fight. Not too many years go by, sometimes even within the lifespan of individuals living, where everything changes. Our enemies are now our friends are enemies, and it goes on and on. What foolishness. And yet we allow ourselves to get drawn in, caught up in that. Why? Because we're holding to one thought or another. It's not necessary. We don't need to do that. The awakened live with nothing more than just observing that they don't get caught. They don't fall into the trap of holding tightly to one view or another. They are not without a view, however, which is important to understand. Because they constantly see, just as anyone else does. They just don't grip, they don't hold. They don't grasp, they don't reach. You start to notice, too, that everything comes up to you. We will work so hard to try to make all the good times come our way and struggle to make all the bad times stay away. Well, you can't do that. In spite of yourself, the good times will keep coming. In spite of yourself, the bad times will keep coming. In spite of yourself, the bad times will go. In spite of yourself, the good times will go. These things just come and go. If we could see that our life was just this impermanence, just this coming and going, all of this stuff that we so much energy and time and effort and confusion and delusion and warring and fighting over so much would just, that just completely occupies our life, this could all fall away. And we could taste the breath of sanity and freedom maybe for the first time. Nothing is lost. We fear, things I love will be, well, no, they won't. Things you love, yeah, they come and go anyway, haven't you noticed? And they will. Your own dear self will go. These things aren't really real, you see, because of this coming and going. But it's in this steady coming and going of everything, just this vibrant change and dynamic reality of the world itself as a whole, that sustains us. That's what's being sustained. Sometimes I've likened it to just a bunch of molecules moving around inside of a balloon. Just that activity just kind of holds the balloon out. There's your stability. You find it in the balloon, but everything that's holding the balloon is just this constant activity. But in the end, what's real is not the individual things jumping around. It's just this whole thing is being sustained, and it's sustaining everything within the balloon, so to speak. You, whatever you think you are, could be nothing more than a molecule. I mean, that's all you can be. And with that constant change, never the same from moment to moment. So, in effect, nothing really there. Nothing actually is formed. It just looks like it. Were we to see that, we wouldn't go reaching, grasping for this or that, but allow this wonderful dynamic reality just to unfold and to enjoy it. The good times come and go, the bad times come and go. We can live in awareness with the lack of, with the freedom from confusion, and just see what this is. And this is what the awakened try to help us notice. Most of all, try to help us notice how we bind ourselves in confusion. Yeah.
I find myself wanting to make things right, make things better, take up some sort of activism, be it social or environmental or political or something. And yet, sometimes I kind of hesitate because in each of these things, there's a whole belief system incorporated into each of these movements. And I'm wondering, well, do I believe this or not? Or is there something here that is really valid that I should be acting upon? And in light of your comments, still kind of asking that question, is there an action that can be taken? It always seems to be based on some set of beliefs.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's what we'll do. Yeah, we'll do that first. We'll form the beliefs, and then we act out of that rigid formulation. Well, say if a concern for the environment. Surely there's a rational way we can go about and help people to realize our dependence on the environment. And we can do this in a way without, say, attacking, vilifying the industrialist or whoever, you know, that might be polluting a river or the air or whatever. That's where we go wrong, you see. We'll solidify it into us versus them. When in fact, actually, if you go back and think about what's your concern again? Aren't you concerned about all of us? And isn't this person here who you were about ready to condemn, aren't they also suffering from this? Could it be that maybe they're just confused? And isn't there a way maybe we can work to help all of us out of our confusion? So we can learn to do that. We have to be extremely patient. Maybe we can't be so point-like in our focus, you know, going after that. You know, next thing you know, like I said, the fundamentalist or whatever, you put the blinders on, it starts to get narrow. Things start to get brittle and rigid, and we don't see what is out there. So this is what we need to be watching for. But is there something you can do about this? Yes, but the awakened, they're always working toward, they're moving toward wholeness. That's what they're looking at, not the narrow. So you find yourself in opposition with something else that's going to push back. Well, that might be an indication that maybe you're taking the wrong approach here. But it doesn't mean that we have to sit on our hands and do nothing, you know. You know, I myself, I don't sit on my hands and do nothing. 7 days a week, I practice. I do what I can to help myself out of my confusion and to help others. And sometimes I'm wrong, but I keep watching that. Like Bertrand Russell, I might be wrong. Because, you see, overall, I can see the situation here, but when you get into when you're dealing with particulars, yeah, at any moment, you could be wrong. So just keep watching for that. But maybe we can work in a way where we allow things to open up to the whole. That's the way of the awakened. That's what they will do. They will direct our attention back to that. So that's where we need to just be mindful of that, bring ourselves back to that. And not that there's nothing there to look for. That's, again, like nothing to believe, see? Okay? But looking back the other way, where everything's particularized, that we can see. We can see the Buddhists don't see the enlightenment. They see the delusion. And they just don't step into it. So we can watch when we're getting drawn into a fight, drawn into a combative situation. We can be watchful of that. And we can start to learn to recognize when we're doing that and realize this isn't the right approach to take, ever. And we move back toward wholeness. What are we aiming at now? Well, nothing in particular, really. Enlightenment is field-like. It's not point-like. You know, awakening, wholeness, totality is field-like. Our delusion is point-like. Our grasping is point-like. You know, our confusion is point-like. And we can spot that. So, like, so many of us in our confusion, we keep looking for where is enlightenment? Where, you know, and we're going to find some point out there that's called enlightenment, but it isn't like that. When we wake up, we start to realize, oh, you realize what delusion is. We realize what we're grasping, what we're reaching for, what we're insisting or forcing through. So this is how we can turn our attention and then allow that to inform us about how to act, what to say, what to do in the next moment. It's never a specific thing, and there's no particular rule or law that could be applied here. But it's a matter of just being continuously aware, present. Yeah. So that help you there, Peter? Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
I get caught up in looking for enlightenment or remember as something, you know, just that feels like everything else, because, you know, I'm crazy and I can superimpose in my life, you know, that'll help me learn how to live.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like what I'm hearing you say is that maybe that we're awake right now and that the practice is just in the
Well, the practice and the living is one and the same. We either practice our confusion or we practice awakening. But there's nothing, you know, veiling us or blocking us from enlightenment, from truth, from reality. We're already in this and of it. That's where we put our trust, our faith. We can trust that. And like I said earlier, there's really no choice. There's a lot I could say about that, actually, and I will someday, I hope. I'm working on a book on this. But we really don't have any choice, and that can be demonstrated. It's not a matter of faith or belief. But anyway, this is reality, and there's nothing blocking you. It's just that we ourselves, out of our confusion, we put up the barriers and the veils. Yeah, so the enlightened, all they have done, other than what most of us, where we're caught up in our delusions, they recognize them for what they are, and they don't get caught. In a nutshell, that's kind of the whole thing right there. So it isn't a matter that they've got something we don't have. No, that's not true at all. But they recognize something we don't recognize, and that's called delusion, confusion. They recognize that. Nancy, did you have something?
Well, I was thinking another philosopher and friends at the same time. Camus had this idea that the ultimate question of life was to choose life or death. That was the biggest question in your life. Mm-hmm. And he developed this philosophy, and a lot of people started to follow him, and a lot of them killed themselves.
Ah.
And he didn't. Mm. And I don't remember any comments of his about maybe I was wrong, but very narrow,
Well, that's just a dangerous thing, no matter what. And no matter how healthy it might seem at the beginning, I would say, you know, if you're following a particular belief or line of thought or whatever, you know, just be very careful there. And that's why I think the Nagarjuna series that we do here is so important, because there where we, you know, every chapter in that book is examination of one thing or another. And it's true examination of what we think about this, about that. It's very important that we start to realize, of course, what scares people, what gets them so frustrated is that, okay, everything's falling apart, now what? But we don't have to worry about that because we're here. Yeah, all that's falling apart is our delusion. It's pretty hard to sustain it. That's what we need to do. And so we can learn up front, at least, to just, you know, you're following a certain belief structure or whatever, and just realize that this is going to just carry you into deeper and deeper into delusion. You're going to start to identify with it. You're going to kind of, you know, you're going to set yourself off from the other in some way. And at no point, you show me any one of these systems that ever brings you to the truth, to something that everybody can stand back and say, oh my gosh, yeah, look at that. Universal truth, we can all see it now. They don't do that, you see, because they just keep getting narrow. It's a matter of us just, that's delusion, that's human delusion. Awakening is to see just that. And then, so, well, okay, so what, so the Buddhas are putting something, well, you notice that nothing's really been put there, you see. We don't hold up something as the truth that you should believe in or think. There are a lot of Buddhists that do, but that's okay. Because we're human beings, so human beings create all kinds of stuff, including Buddhism that's delusional. So there's a lot of delusional Buddhism. There's probably more delusional Buddhism than not. But nevertheless, if we go back to these very simple, direct teachings, they can take us out of this. Yeah. Yes?
How do we break through all these veils when our habits are so persistent? We're using, like, basically, like, we have all these concepts about the way things are, and with Buddhism, we're also using concepts to break down concepts.
Yeah.
You know, so, mm-hmm. How do we work?
That's a good question. And Nagarjuna addresses that one about not getting caught up in this method of breaking down concepts, and then we hold to that idea, you know, of emptiness. Well, here's the thing, you see, I could probably say a number of things about that, but let me just focus on a couple of important points here. You had said something about how do we break through and that sort of thing. You should realize that that very approach of trying to break through, wrestle something, is a wrong approach. Also, we think in our practice there's a lot of straining and striving and, you know, muscling our way through in one way or another, either intellectually or through the practice or the sitting or whatever. This should never be done at any time. It is simply a matter of learning to see what is going on there. And the stuff that is delusional, the stuff that is confusion, that drops away of its own accord. You don't need to throw it out. You don't need to push it. You don't need to do anything with it. That just falls away. So it's a matter of just looking at this and seeing this. But you've already made a good observation there, noticing that everything that you would grab hold of to help throw this thing out is just another thing that you're holding to. I think that's the gist of what you were saying, right? Yeah. Well, that's very important that we start to notice that, as you have. At some point, what we need to recognize is that you don't need to keep putting something there. We think we do, but actually we don't. And it's a matter of just coming to realize that directly. Don't take my word for it. So it's simply a matter of when something shows up, we just look at it. We can also notice how we might be grasping hold of it. And we favor it, we like it, and we're going to keep it and identify with it, or we're going to push it off. We can start to notice that we do this. That is all we need to do. But this is extremely subtle, the degree to which we get caught in these ways. And it might take us quite a while to begin to appreciate that. But in the end, there's nothing more to do about that, because what starts to happen, when you start to recognize what's painful, what is inconclusive, what doesn't give you the actual ground that you thought you had, once you start to notice this, you simply cannot sustain it. And it isn't like you have to now forcefully throw it off. You can't help but let it go. You want it to go. It's just going to drop away. It's a dead weight. You don't want to lug that around with you anymore. So it kind of works like that. And we're no longer concerned with trying to draw something in that I need to support myself now while I'm doing all these other things. No, everything. We can let it drop away. And we notice, here we are. We've been sustained by reality all along. Yeah. Well, I'm not saying about not having beliefs.
Not getting
caught by that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So my thinking I'm struggling with is, it seems to me like I see a value in that not being attached with beliefs because they just create awareness and suffering. But then, where does that lead the human race as the people? I mean, I like to believe in unending love and the transforming power of love that can affect all human races.
Well, that's just an abstraction. That's just an abstraction, though. Love is love. Transformation is transformation. Reality is reality. You don't need to force it. You don't need to grasp it or create it or define it or try to shape it or say it's like this or it's like that. Just let it be what it is. Just because we slap labels on it and we try to define relationships between different things or whatever and draw theories up around all of this has nothing to do with it. Reality is reality, and just enjoy that. Yes, love is a wonderful thing. But I don't need to say anything about that. Just know the experience for what it is, as it's unfolding, as it's taking place.
If there is love, well, then what's the point of these tears? And with the two, the idea of good and evil, then there always has to be the suffering. Because if you really want one, then the other is still present and giving previous emotions.
Well, good and evil are not opposites. We think that they are, and so we think that somehow good and evil have to duke it out. That's delusion. Yeah. Evil, what we might call evil, is always going to be something particular, something we can always point to, we can always see, but we can never see good. We can never identify good. Good is of the whole, it's of totality. And if we just learn not to get caught up in this, good is just simply there. It's been there all along, were we to just not get caught up, driving this out, forcing it through, whatever. So it's a radically different approach to this matter of good and evil. But the old dualistic way of looking at good and evil just in itself perpetuates what we might otherwise call evil. You know, it's profound human delusion to think in these ways. And it's just simply not healthy, doesn't work, doesn't match reality, and it's got to go. And we got to go. So I probably have to end it here, but... But I'm writing a book that's going to deal with that. There's a lot to this. I could give a series of talks on just this very issue that you raised right there. All right, we'll end on a happy note. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.